Good evening, my lovelies, and welcome to the new and improved Flypaper Dungeon podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Zombie. And before I get on with the new music, new intro, new format, new everything, I would like to bring to your attention a very important cause, which concerns someone that myself and the listeners of the show care about very deeply. As you all know, our good friend Leda Locke has been battling cancer these past few months, and she is successfully winning that battle. However, as a result of chemotherapy, she will be unable to bear children on her own. And so, she will have to do egg harvesting, in vitro fertilization, as it's called. Her ovum will have to be harvested, and then frozen, and then implanted into a surrogate. Her in vitro fertilization is not covered by any medical plans, and so in order for this to become a reality, a lot of money has to be raised. In this case, about $30,000 or so. So I'm calling upon you, the listeners, to please give what you can. Even if you give a little, even if you give a lot, whatever you can give, it will definitely make a difference. You can donate to her via her PayPal, which is located at ledalocke@yahoo.com. That is ledalocke@yahoo.com. And I will post further information in the show notes for this episode. Give what you can. It will be greatly appreciated. And as soon as you donate, send me an email at flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. And you will be greatly rewarded with an audiobook recording of me reading H.P. Lovecraft's classic, Herbert West, Reanimator. So, please give what you can to ledalocke@yahoo.com, and I thank you for your support. And now, on with the debauchery. Allowed by the wonderful, fantastic Mr. Goat. Seriously, that's the guy's name, Goat. Fantastic musician. He does these sort of heavy metal style compositions. Fantastic. So, welcome to the Flypaper Dungeon, a weekly updated podcast by your host, Mr. Johnny Zombie. And this week, the subject is Evil Babies. Yes. Oddly enough, I had a plug for in vitro fertilization at the beginning of this episode. Not what I intended originally. I intended to give that plug, but I didn't intend to do an Evil Babies episode originally. But it's a subject that came up because I had seen a movie called Grace recently, which will be discussed in this episode. And it's a movie that I did enjoy, but I was very critical of. I did have problems with it, and I'd really wanted to discuss it. And then I'd thought of Rosemary's Baby, which I hadn't watched for quite a while, and it was on one of the on-demand channels here on my cable. So I decided to revisit Roman Polanski's adaptation of Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby, a film that I enjoyed a long time ago when I first saw it back in the 90s, and I still enjoy now. And so that is how the concept of evil babies was born. Not including one of the most famous evil babies of all, Mr. Stewie Griffin, who will not be making an appearance tonight. Sorry to disappoint you, Family Guy fans. So normally at this part of the show, I would do some news and reviews. Instead, I am going to do a talking points, because there's really no current news to report or any current reviews other than what I'm going to discuss in this episode. Feedback for any section of this episode, whether it be news and reviews, talking points, the reviews themselves, the topic discussed, Scream Queen of the Week, or from the vaults, is greatly appreciated. And you can reach me at flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. Again, that is flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. Please send your comments there, or in the comments box below the show notes for this episode. So tonight's talking points is a potentially controversial one, and that is this. The Star Wars Blu-ray box set. Apparently all six episodes will be available in one box set for $150. It doesn't look like they're going to separate them or make the individual trilogies available. In other words, 1 through 3 in a separate box from 4 from 6. The prequels and the original trilogy separated. Instead, they're going to be all together in one box. They're going to be on Blu-ray, which is big news because this is the first time that the Star Wars trilogy has been released on Blu-ray. In fact, after getting the special editions on DVD, we weren't supposed to get the original theatrical cuts, the non-special edition versions, but eventually those were made available. And this isn't the only time that a Lucas franchise has been re-released on DVD and in various other formats. The Indiana Jones movies were initially released in a box set and were then released separately, and then another box set was made with all 4 of the movies, as opposed to the original box set that simply contained the first 3. I imagine that an Indiana Jones Blu-ray box set will be forthcoming. I would imagine that Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is already in Blu-ray, and with the advent of the new 3D TV sets, who knows, there might be a 3D Indiana Jones, or a re-release of the theatrical Indiana Jones films redone in 3D, just as there is supposed to be a Star Wars 3D. Although Lucas said he won't do it, from what I've discovered recently, it sounds like he will do it, and that it will be either within the next year or the year after that. So my talking point is this. Do we need another Star Wars boxed set? I'm not anti-Blu-ray. I believe, personally, that Blu-ray is a bit overhyped. I'm not against it, but I believe that it is grossly overhyped. I don't see too much of a difference between DVD and Blu-ray, to be honest with you, and I think it has more to do with your TV set rather than the actual format. But that's another discussion. The point is, why would we... No, I can't talk. Why would we need to rebuy the same movies that we already have? We already have the Star Wars movies on DVD, and yes, the DVDs look so much better than the original VHS. The original VHS tapes were grainy, even the special edition remastered tapes. Eventually VHS would wear out. So, obviously, you had to replace it with DVD. It is a superior format, it does look a hell of a lot better, and the same picture and sound quality will always be there, as I'm sure it will be for Blu-ray. But if you already have these movies on DVD, why bother rebuying them on Blu-ray? I mean, I enjoy the Star Wars movies myself, but I just think that it's a bit overkill that we have box set after box set of essentially the same films. The only thing that this box set can give you is possibly slightly brighter colors and a slightly louder soundtrack, and a bunch of bonus features, which would mostly be on the box set already. There might be a few more bonus features that they can eke out, maybe director's commentary, maybe some commentary from George Lucas, who knows. But there's not a whole lot more that you can do with films that are already done. Unless Lucas goes and re-edits the films all over again and re-adds new scenes just for the Blu-ray, just to kind of sweeten the deal. Now, this is something that came up on Horror Etc. some time ago, the concept of double-dipping. When a film is released on a no-frills, you know, single-disc edition, and then a few months down the road, there's a special two-disc edition set with bonus features and a director's cut and audio commentaries and everything else. All kinds of fancy fixins, whereas the original release was just a bare-bones version of it. And more often than not, the special edition costs a few dollars more. The bare bones has an original release might be like $20, and then your special edition might be like 25 or 30. Or more often than not these days, the special edition is 20, and your new release might be about $15, depending upon where you get it from. When Peter Jackson released the Lord of the Rings films on DVD, you know, they were a bit more honest about it. You know, he released the regular theatrical cuts with a few bonus features for people who were just enjoyed the movies but weren't serious fans. And then for the major fans, there were the extended cuts and the special editions that were released sometime after that. And Jackson was honest and upfront about it, that there would be two different versions available for you. One for the people that saw it in the theaters and just enjoyed it, and then one for the serious fans of Lord of the Rings. And actually, I think they were released around the same time, in similar formats. I remember when Walk the Line was released on DVD, the special two-disc edition was released at exactly the same time. So, if you just wanted the movie, you could just buy the disc. If you wanted both, which included the soundtrack and the special edition, you could get that as well. It used to really kind of irk me when I would buy a movie when it just came out, a movie that I had seen in theaters and really enjoyed and wanted to revisit, and then a few months down the road, a special two-disc set comes out, and it's like, do I rebuy the same movie again just so I can get director's commentary and special features and whatever else have you that comes with it? And one could almost complain about the Criterion Collection. The Criterion Collection really is good, and if you're a fan of a particular film, you may want to get the Criterion version of it. Like, for example, I'm a big fan of Terry Gilliam, and I may want to get the Criterion version of Brazil. I just don't want to have to pay $40 for it. You know, a lot of those box sets are outrageously priced. I bought a box set of Fellini's 8½ some time ago. It's a double-disc set. And I only was able to buy it because I worked at the place where I bought it, and so I was able to get it very greatly discounted. Otherwise, I would not have bought it. It would have been way too expensive. And then there are some Criterion discs that are just one disc, and yet they bilk you for that as well. So, double dipping is something that has been around for eons, and it's not going away, apparently, even in the advent of Blu-ray, but eventually I think it will get to a point where people will just get sick of it, and they'll be like, why should I rebuy the same film just to get a few extra megapixels, or just to get an extra bonus commentary with it? So, that's my talking points for this week, and if anybody wants to weigh in on this, you can email me at flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. And let me know what you think. So, up next, tonight's topic, evil babies. Minus Stewie Griffin. first up on the evil babies topic is a film called Grace. Not to be confused with the documentary about Jeff Buckley. Most a pity. Because I hear it's pretty good, though I have not yet seen it. Grace is a film from 2009, directed by Paul Soleil. It is his first feature-length film. It stars Jordan Ladd, the daughter of famous, Charlie's Angels fame, Cheryl Ladd, has Madeline, and Stephen Park has her husband, Michael, based on Soleil's 2006 short film of the same title, which starred Lisa Weil of Gilmore Girls fame, and Brian Austin Green. And I'm going to see about inserting a link to that in the show notes, because the short film is actually quite good. And basically, the plot is this. A distraught mother gives birth to a baby that feeds on blood. The baby is initially stillborn. She begins to breastfeed the baby and essentially wills it back to life. It's a very unusual film. A very unique idea, and one that I looked forward to seeing very eagerly. I felt that this was a great idea for a film, a very original horror film, and one that I had really wanted to see ever since I first saw a preview of it. And I finally got the chance to see it about a week ago, and I did enjoy this film, but I had problems with it. I just want to get that out in the open first, that even though I did enjoy this film, it's not a perfect film. It does have its flaws. And it does have moments where you will be looking at the screen kind of askance with an eyebrow raised going, huh? But all in all, it is a worthwhile film. It is worth checking it out, especially for Jordan Ladd's performance, which really stands out in the film. The film begins with a sex scene. First of all, I'm going to try my best not to spoil this. I'm going to try, from now on, when I do my reviews, to not spoil anything. And when I discuss Rosemary's Baby later on in this episode, I will not spoil it. Even though it's a much older film, there are some people who may have not seen it yet, some younger listeners of the show. And so I will not spoil that, and I will try my damnedest not to spoil Grace. But there are certain points of the film, certain scenes, little highlights that I do want to pick out and analyze a bit. So the film begins with a sex scene with the rather gorgeous Jordan Ladd, who is fantastic in this film, and she immediately becomes pregnant. We know about her character Madeline that she is a vegetarian. Her husband is not. And there's a very awkward dinner scene at the beginning with her in-laws, where her mother-in-law kind of looks a little uneasy at the vegetarian dishes that Madeline has prepared. We don't know why, but for some strange reason, she's not too hip on vegetarians, and it kind of icks her out that Madeline's a vegetarian. It might be possible that this represents the whole kind of conservative versus liberal thing, the fact that Madeline is a bit of a new ager, a bit liberal, a bit left, and the family that her husband comes from is a bit right-wing. But the dinner scene is a very awkward scene as well. And then the scene after that is basically the morning after. And this is one of the little odd points I just want to pick out. That Madeline is a vegetarian, and I think that's cool. I have no problem with people being vegetarians. In fact, Peter Cushing was a vegetarian, and there are times when I think about being a vegetarian as well. But here's one of the little odd points of the film. She's watching this video, Madeline is watching this video of animals being slaughtered and being kept in slaughterhouses and the like, and being kept in pens. It's really gross stuff. It's actually more brutal than the actual violence in the film. It's all very odd, but this is like the only video she ever watches. We see it on this little TV screen that she has. It's almost like a computer monitor screen in her kitchen. Oddly enough, while she's cooking, she watches these videos, and it's all we ever see on that screen. And I was thinking maybe she was trying to convert her husband to vegetarianism by showing these videos to him. I don't quite get it, but it's always there, it's always on in the background, and it's never really explained, and it just felt kind of odd that someone who's already a vegetarian would continue to watch the stuff, not to mention the fact that she's doing this while she's cooking, even though she's not cooking any meat. Still, you think it would put you off your food. It certainly put me off my food for the rest of the day when I saw it, as did this film, oddly enough. But here's another little odd point. She has a cat. Madeline and her husband have this cat named Joe, beautiful black cat. And she tries to feed the cat a vegetarian diet. She gives him soy milk, and the cat rejects it. The cat brings a dead mouse to the door, which is normal for a cat to do that, and when a cat does that, you thank them for it and give them some praise, and when they're not looking, dispose of the corpse. The corpse of the mouse. Keep the cat around, they're killing the mice. Regardless of how you feel about it, that's a cat's nature, it's a hunt. They're predatory. They will not eat a vegetarian diet. In fact, in The Idiot's Guide to Cats, it even says so. Some vegetarians will try to convert their pets to vegetarianism. And again, no disrespect to anyone who's a vegetarian, but cats and dogs are carnivorous. They're predatory, and they will not eat a vegetarian diet. In fact, it's unhealthy for them to eat a vegetarian diet. If they do that, they can get sick. They need to eat meat. They need the proteins they get from animal-based substances. They can't eat anything that's artificial or plant-based. It's just not good for them. It's just not going to be accepted to their system. And even though her character is very much an animal rights kind of person, and she seems like she would be an animal lover. Well, she is. She just doesn't seem to acknowledge this, and she tries to feed her cat a vegetarian diet, which her cat rejects. And when her cat brings the dead mouse to the door, she puts on rubber gloves, like the kind you would use to wash up the dishes. And she initially goes to grab the mouse with those gloves to throw it in the garbage. But then she stops and she puts on a pair of mitts, like snow mittens. And she uses mittens over the rubber gloves to throw the mouse into the garbage, which I thought was kind of odd. I could understand using the rubber gloves, I would too, but the mitts? Maybe this is just nitpicking on my part, but I just felt it was a little strange. And then she covers the mouse with dirt after she throws it in the garbage. Very odd. Maybe she meant it to be like a form of humane burial for the mouse, but just weird. So her husband gives her a piece of liver to cook for dinner that night, for him. And again, this is kind of an odd point. And this is something that is kind of built upon a little bit in the short film, but not built upon in the film proper. If you're married to a vegetarian, you would think you would try to avoid eating meat products, or at least try to avoid having your spouse cook it. You'd think you would cook it yourself. She cooks it for him, this liver and onions, but it makes her squeamish, cooking it, and it makes her squeamish watching her husband eat it. And you would just think that her husband would be a bit more empathetic towards his wife and realize, hey, she's a vegetarian, I'm not going to force her to cook meat, but he does. Again, very strange. And her husband, Michael, is a very nice guy. He's very soft-spoken, very quiet, doesn't quite get her vegetarian lifestyle, doesn't quite get a lot of her beliefs and so on, but he's not judgmental, he's not a mean guy at all. Whereas in the short film, where Brian Austin Green played Michael, he was kind of judgmental. There's a scene at the very beginning of the short film, where Green and Weil are driving. They're going down the road, and he's very critical of his wife. He says, "I don't want our baby born in some new age hippie clinic. I don't want a midwife handling our baby. I want our baby to be born in a hospital, damn it, And he's very forceful about it, and very very macho and very right-wing all about it. And yet, in the film, Michael's very gentle. In the feature-length film, he does not protest the I was going to say neonatal clinic, but I don't think that's the correct word for it, the birthing center, or the midwifery, or anything like that. It doesn't really bother him that she's going to do this. Again, he doesn't quite understand, but he accepts it. It's not a bone of contention between him and his wife. And then that brings me to the birthing clinic, which is the next scene up. It's kind of a new agey place. The receptionist gives them vegan cookies, which Michael doesn't eat. That kind of turned him off that they were vegan cookies, but I don't know why. Anyways, he doesn't really protest it. It's just a little character point. And we meet the director of the clinic, who is Patricia. And Patricia has this odd quirk of scraping the finish off the drawer of her desk with her thumbnail. It's really weird, and it's never explained why she does it. I guess maybe a nervous reaction, a nervous tic, but it's just an odd little character trait that there's no explanation given for it. And as it turns out, and this is a bit of a spoiler, but... Well, a bit of a spoiler, but it's necessary to mention. As it turns out, Patricia had a relationship with Madeline at one point. It's revealed soon after that there was a romantic relationship that they had together. So we've learned that Madeline, you know, was bisexual, or excuse me, is bisexual, or at some point was experimenting with her sexuality and had a same-sex lover. We don't know too much about the relationship. We just know that they were very close. They lived together. And it's never commented on if her husband knew about this, that Patricia and Madeline were lovers at one time. It's never commented on whether on her sexual orientation at all. It's just mentioned that at one time her and Patricia were lovers. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with bisexual or lesbian or gay characters in films. It's just that it felt a little odd. This is one of the, not really a complaint, but just a little kind of a tic. I'm trying to think of a correct way to describe it. Just a little oddity. Just something that didn't quite seem to fit with the narrative or with the film. It just seemed like it was kind of thrown in there. And I don't know if the filmmaker intended for that to be an exploitable element or to raise the stakes, but it just felt like a cheap device. It didn't really feel like it belonged in this film. You know, it just felt really kind of odd to me, and the fact that it's never really commented on. And eventually it does pay off towards the end of the film. It does wind up being used, but again, it just feels very clumsy to me. So, while having dinner, there's this incident where Madeline begins to feel chest pains. It almost feels like she's having a heart attack. And they rush her to the hospital, and as it turns out, she is pre-eclampsia, and she is in danger of losing the baby. So they have to induce her right away, but if they do, the baby is going to be born prematurely. While they are there, I should add that prior to the hospital, Michael was on his cell phone talking to his mom. And as a result of this, the mom, the mother-in-law, freaks out, and her family doctor arrives at the hospital to meet Madeline and Michael. He is not Madeline's doctor. Patricia is her midwife, and Patricia does hold a doctorate. She actually is a medical doctor, a trained medical doctor from Columbia University. And so she has just as much a right to be there. She is, after all, the midwife, and for all intents and purposes, the OBGYN here. And so there's a bit of a conflict between them. They don't have her numbers, they don't have her vitals, they haven't taken a CAT scan or anything like that. They just simply brought her to the hospital, and Dr. Soans is his name. He's the family doctor. He wants to induce her right away, deliver the baby. She refuses. You know, she's freaking out. Patricia stands up and says, "You can't do that. You know, you'll run the risk of losing this baby, etc. You know, let's make sure it's not a gallstone or something else. Let's make sure that, you know, this really is preeclampsia and that she's in danger of losing the baby or in danger of dying." And so in the end, it turns out to be nothing. And while Michael and Patricia are driving home, they have an accident. quite a bad accident, Michael dies. And this isn't spoiling anything really, because this is in the short film, and this is just, you know, like a basic plot point. Michael dies as a result of this accident. And this is where the short film actually begins, with that incident. Soon after, Madeline goes back to the birthing center. Not to any other kind of hospital, but to a birthing center. And oddly enough, the assistant, Patricia's assistant, says to her, "We really need to take her to a hospital and get her checked out." And Patricia says, "She'll be fine. She'll deliver the baby on her own." Meanwhile, Madeline is covered in blood. There's blood all over her pants, around her, okay, I'll just say it, around her intimate area, around her vagina. She's totally bloody in her pants. You know, it looks like she may have miscarried, or like her water broke and she was hemorrhaging at the same time. It looks really bad. But they don't take her pants off, they don't take her clothes off, they don't clean her up, they just kind of leave her that way, which I thought was really weird again. And they don't really even check her out. She's just lying on this cot in this delivery room, and they're just watching her through a TV monitor. It's really bizarre. So she gives birth in a birthing pool, which is a pool of, like, lukewarm water that some birthing centers do have. She gives birth, and the baby is stillborn. In fact, she was informed before she gave birth that the baby would be stillborn, that the baby had indeed died inside of her. This is something that Patricia informed her. It's not, there's no scene where she's told that the baby is dead. It's just commented on as they're watching her through the TV monitor. And she carries this dead infant to term. And she gives birth to a dead baby. And the baby looks pretty gruesome. this is really good. I guess it was made out of silicone, because it looks so realistic. But little baby Grace really looks deceased. It looks pretty awful when she is born. It's not a beautiful scene. It's a very brutal scene. Not that birth isn't brutal in real life, but in this scene in particular, it's very brutal. And she does not look healthy at all, and she's not breathing. And then she begins to breastfeed Grace. And then Grace comes back to life through breastfeeding. Very bizarro. And as it turns out, Grace is, in effect, a zombie baby. When Madeline takes her home, flies start buzzing around the house. Grace smells kind of funny. She just doesn't smell right. She checks Grace's nappies, and there's no mess. Grace will not drink regular milk. In fact, she begins to kind of bite down on Madeline's breast and begins to suck so hard that she bleeds. Now, granted, a baby this young would not have teeth yet, but somehow she's able to get Madeline's boob to bleed. It's really weird, and bleed quite profusely as well. In fact, so profusely that she's, like, hemorrhaging through her bra. It's quite brutal. There's some amazing body horror in this film. And, as it turns out, the only thing that will satisfy baby Grace is blood. Specifically, her mother's blood. She tries to feed her blood from the grocery store. She buys all these packages of meat and drains the blood from them. Which, again, is kind of odd, because you could just buy pig's blood from a butcher shop, but she buys all these packages of meat and drains them. And then tries feeding it to Grace, who promptly spits it back up. She needs her mom's blood. Very, very bizarre. And then there was a plot involving the mother-in-law trying to get the baby back from her. And this is a bit of an odd twist in the film, because her mother-in-law is a lawyer, or excuse me, a judge, actually. And she could very easily have gotten a court order to take Grace and her as the next of kin, maintain hold of her. But instead, she tries to conspire with the family doctor, Dr. Soans, to kill Madeline. We're not certain how he's going to do it, but to kill Madeline and take Grace away. It's very, very odd. In fact, during the mother's grieving process, Vivian is the mother-in-law's name, during her grieving process, she gets really, really strange. Just very, very, very bizarre. I mean, grief does strange things to people, but we don't see scenes of the funeral or anything like that. Just this very odd behavior in her. Like she forces herself to start lactating again, even though she's way past menopause. And I actually did some research, and as it turns out, it is very plausible. It is plausible to re-stimulate lactation in a woman's breast long after menopause. I'm not going to go into the specifics. Those of you that want to experiment are more than welcome to. In fact, I wouldn't mind experimenting myself. But that's another story for another podcast. And I've actually made a note about this, that it is medically possible to do this. And there's a very bizarro scene where Vivian forces her husband to suck on her boobs. She's kind of playing with her boobs, trying to make herself lactate. They get ready to have sex. And, you know, he starts to suck on her boobs for a little bit. And he gets ready to make love to her. And then she kind of stops him. And just wants him to suck on her boobs the whole time. Almost like she's breastfeeding him. And, you know, I'm a breast man myself. You know, I enjoy good breastfeeding. Who doesn't? But, it kind of reminded me of the quote in Silence of the Lambs. That scene where Hannibal Lecter meets the senator's... the senator, yeah, whose daughter has been kidnapped. The senator who was played by Diane Baker. And he says to her, "Did you breastfeed your daughter?" And she says, "Yes." And then he says, "You know, if a man has his leg amputated, he experiences phantom limbs. When your daughter is dead, how will it tickle you?" It made me think of that. Like she was having this kind of... like she was infantilizing her husband to take the place of the son. It was really bizarro. And the movie gets even weirder after that. It's a very short film. It's about 85 minutes long. And I don't want to go too much further because I don't want to spoil the ending. But there is an epilogue to this film that is rather gross. It's an epilogue that is unnecessary and it feels very tacked on. The way that the film ends is actually quite satisfactory, minus the epilogue. I don't want to say too much more because I will have to spoil the ending if I do, but the film does end quite predictably with a confrontation between Madeline and Vivian, with Grace's fate hanging in the balance. And if it just ended with that confrontation scene and the outcome of that confrontation, then I would have been a bit more satisfied with this film. Instead, the film ends with this bizarro epilogue that felt very tacked on, and it almost felt like it was a direct-to-DVD kind of feature, rather than an actual part of a motion picture. There are parts of this film that do feel like they're theatrical quality, and some parts that feel like a direct-to-DVD or direct-to-video movie that you would see late night on cable. Again, it's not a bad film, and I did enjoy watching it, but at the same time, I do have problems with it. It's not a perfect film, and it does have some major flaws. And you can tell it's from a first-time director. And it feels like... it almost feels like certain cliches from Screenwriting 101 books were adhered to in this film. And then there were some original ideas thrown in, and the two are in conflict with each other. And it makes for kind of a jarring effect. Not too bad, but still a bit of a jarring effect. Now, the great highlight of this film, actually two great highlights. The first is Jordan Ladd's performance. She is great in this film. I've seen her in a few films. Most notably, she was in Death Proof, if I'm not mistaken. Again, she is an absolutely beautiful woman and a fantastic actress. I was very impressed with her performance. She is not a mother in real life herself, but she acts like she is. I could very easily believe her as a tired mother, a mother whose baby is crying and keeping her awake, and her husband has just died, and she's under tremendous stress. I could easily believe her doing that, and she does have this very tired, very haggard look to her. And just phenomenally well played by Jordan Ladd, just fantastic. The other highlight, the other star of this film, are the various babies that play Grace. They're absolutely adorable. She is the cutest little baby on screen. Unfortunately, she is a zombie, but she's absolutely adorable. And I can't wait till her parents, many, many years from now, have the conversation with her where they say, "You know, when you were a little baby, you played in a horror film where you sucked on your mom's boobs till they bled." Needless to say, we did not breastfeed you. So, Grace, not a bad film. It does have flaws, but those of you that want to see a fantastic performance from Jordan Ladd, check it out. Those of you that are into body horror and some extreme ickiness, feel free to check it out. I would say rent it. You know, it's not a film that you would want to watch again, probably. You certainly would not want to buy it, but I would say rent it. It's a fair shot, and give it a chance. Next up is Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby from 1968, released June 12th, 1968, which is 11 years and 6 days before my own birth. Very strange indeed. Coincidence? Probably not. Then again, The Omen was released on my birthday, 3 years before I was born. And the remake was released on my birthday, in 2006. So, coincidence? Again, probably not. But anyways, Rosemary's Baby, based on the Ira Levin novel, adapted and directed by Roman Polanski, stars Mia Farrow as Rosemary, John Cassavetes as her husband Guy, Ruth Gordon, best known for her roles in Harold and Maude, and the Any Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can movies. Has Minnie Castevetz. Sydney Blackmer has Roman, her husband, and Charles Grodin has Dr. Hill. Very odd role for Charles Grodin. It's strange to see him in a drama like this instead of a comedy. And this is a very famous film, so the plot kind of goes without saying, but here it goes. A mother becomes pregnant with Satan's son. Due date June 28th, 1966. 666. And speaking of which, on the New Year's Eve scene, Roman says 1966, the year one. Just a little bit of trivia there. So this is a highly controversial film. It was controversial back in its day, and probably still controversial today. I first saw it when I was a teenager in the 90s. The Sci-Fi Channel had actually shown it as part of their Satan Lives marathon, something they probably wouldn't do today. All the nudity was excised from it when Sci-Fi showed it, but the main content of the film was still there. The nudity was actually quite tasteful. It wasn't in your face or anything like that. But then again, this was 1968, so it's not going to be too in your face. The Ira Levin novel was published in 1966 and was an instantaneous bestseller. Some believe it was spurred on as a bestseller because the Church of Satan had been founded a year earlier, and there was some controversy surrounding that, of course, and so things that became Satan or Satan-themed became very popular around this time, spurred on a few years later, in the 70s, by the popularity of The Exorcist. So as mentioned before, the film stars Mia Farrow, who was largely unknown at the time. She had done the TV adaptation of Peyton Place, and she had married Frank Sinatra. She was married to him very briefly, and that helped to kind of put her into the public consciousness. So it stars Mia Farrow as Rosemary, and John Cassavetes as Guy. And Cassavetes was best known, I think, for his role in The Dirty Dozen, Also a very close friend of Peter Falk in real life. Fantastic actor and director and writer in his own right. And he was one of the early independent cinema guys. So, Rosemary and Guy are a young couple. They move into a building that has kind of a notorious history, a history of suicides and unsavory characters living there. And Elijah Cook is actually the building's super. And I mention his name here because he was in quite a number of William Castle films. And this film was produced by William Castle, but I'll get to that in a few moments. They move into an apartment building that has a history of kind of unsavory characters. One of the former tenants was a witch. There were two women who were tenants that were cannibals, and there's all kinds of bizarre mythology that surrounds this building, all kinds of ickiness. Well, Rosemary befriends a young woman who lives in the building named Terry, and immediately after befriending her, Terry commits suicide. She is found dead on the sidewalk, blood everywhere. Very orange blood, very similar to the Kensington gore in the Hammer films. She then finds out that this young woman was living with a couple, the Castevets. The Castevets are played by Ruth Gordon has Minnie, and Sydney Blackmer has Roman. And the Castevets are this elderly couple. They live next door to Rosemary and Guy, and in fact, they can hear every single noise that goes on in the Castevets' apartment, including some very, very harmonious satanic chanting. Yes. Very, very good for elderly Satanists. They sound quite nice, actually. They can harmonize well. And so, just a personal note, Ruth Gordon kind of reminds me of my maternal grandmother. And I mean that in a good way. She kind of resembles my maternal grandmother. Or resembled, I should say. Especially the way she looks in this film and with the babushkas that she wears and her makeup. She was the spitting image of my maternal grandmother. Except by, I think my maternal grandmother was a bit taller than her. But that just goes to show you where my mind is. I'm not saying that my grandmother was in league with the devil. No, I'm not saying that, but given my upbringing makes you kind of wonder. Anyways, moving right along. The Castevets are, well, they're an eccentric elderly couple. Roman has traveled everywhere, been all over the world. Minnie is very keen to make friends with Rosemary, especially after the death of Terry. They feel very, very lonely. And she becomes not maternal, but very possessive towards Rosemary, very, very kind of forcing herself into Rosemary's life. And Rosemary and Guy are very hesitant at first. But they have dinner with the Castevets, after a dinner invitation from them. And everything goes well. And there's this very interesting scene where Rosemary is talking with Minnie in the kitchen and helping her do the dishes, while Guy and Roman are in the living room having a cigar and knocking back a few shots, and we don't hear what it is that Roman and Guy are talking about. We don't hear it at all. We have no clue what their conversation is about. In fact, in this film, we only see what Rosemary sees. The camera follows her every single moment. In fact, come to think of it, I don't think there's a single scene where she's not on camera. The camera follows her completely throughout the entire film. Which is quite interesting. It's almost like a first-person point of view in that sense, that we only see what Rosemary sees. Well, soon after that, Rosemary becomes pregnant, but not by ordinary means. Nope. It's an unimmaculate inconception. Yes, this leads to the infamous satanic rape scene. And no, I'm not going to make any rape jokes about Roman Polanski. That's just tasteless. I'll address Roman Polanski and his proclivities later. Very talented filmmaker. I enjoy his movies. I'm just gonna get it out there, out in the open, get on the record on this. Polanski is a very talented filmmaker, and I've enjoyed all the Polanski movies that I have seen. I don't appreciate the fact that he's a fugitive from justice. And that he has been so for over 30 years now. He is a very talented filmmaker. You know, absolute brilliant filmmaker, great at what he does, a great artist. But there is that issue, shall we say. His indiscretion from over 30 some years ago, that kind of hangs over his head. And that has a result of it, if he ever lands on American soil, he'll go to jail for it. But that's another story. Suffice to say that we're talking about his creative work here and not about his personal life, but I just had to get that off my chest and address it, especially with the subject matter that this film deals with. So, after eating a very strange chocolate mousse that was drugged, Rosemary gets all doped up. Basically, you know, the chocolate mousse was drugged. It was made by Minnie. It was given to her by Minnie. And Rosemary gets into this kind of weird drunken stupor, this drug-induced stupor. And she begins to have a very strange dream, which then segues into reality. And the reality of it is that she is laid upon a bed in front of a naked, satanic congregation, and she is then, well, sexually assaulted by Satan. I don't know any other way to put it. The scene is very tastefully shot. It's not exploitive. It's not sexy. It's very icky, actually. Not just the naked, elderly, out-of-shape Satanists, but the actual act itself of this sexual molestation by Satan. And contrary to popular belief, Anton LaVey did not play the devil in this film. There was a long-standing rumor that LaVey had played Satan. As it turns out, Clay Tanner, a character actor who was prominent in the 60s and 70s, and who acted on many westerns, plays the devil in this film. And the devil makeup is extraordinary. It's sort of this very twisted, hairy body. You know, he looks very bestial. He has cloven hands and cloven hooves, and he has horns, you know, and red glowing eyes. Well, not glowing eyes, but just red, almost bloodshot eyes. Very disturbing look for the devil. And we don't see all of him. We don't see his entire face. We don't see every single part of him. But we see enough. And I think that was a great choice on Polanski's part not to show us everything, but to show us enough to know that this is indeed the devil, and this is one bad-looking dude. So, soon after Rosemary becomes pregnant, she wakes up from the incident, and she's tired, and there are scratches on her body. And Guy basically says, "Oh, you know, I didn't want to miss the chance to get you pregnant, because they've been trying to have a baby for a while now. You know, so even though you were a little loopy, you know, we still did it." And Rosemary's a bit miffed about this, but Guy was like, "Hey, it was kind of exciting, a bit like necrophilia. Crack open a cold one." You know, that would still be a little bit creepy, even though it's his wife, you know. You never sleep with a woman if she can't consent. But Guy lies and says that he did, when we all know it was Satan that did it. So, to make matters even worse, Rosemary soon becomes pregnant. And as the story progresses on, she experiences abdominal pains, and she's given this charm to wear by the Castavets called Tanis Root, which is also known as the Devil's Pepper, and it lets off this very foul smell. And Rosemary becomes quite ill. She develops anemia-like symptoms, and rather than gaining weight, she starts to lose weight. It's actually quite disturbing. In fact, I don't want to give away too much of the film, even though this film is over 40 years old. It's a great film, and it still packs a punch. It packs a tremendous punch, and it's a film that I very much enjoy, and that I would recommend to others. And so I'm going to try my. Well, actually, I'm not going to try. I'm just not going to spoil it at all. But I do have a few notes, a few points to make here. Not the least of which is this. Mia Farrow was actually served divorce papers while making this film. Frank Sinatra had served her divorce papers. Sinatra did not want Mia Farrow to continue her career. I don't know why, but he just didn't. So, quoting from the website, as CVSP calls it, which is slang for Wikipedia, One of Mia Farrow's more emotionally charged scenes occurs in the midst of a party, when several of Rosemary's female friends lock Guy out of the kitchen, as they console her in private. It's a very strong scene, very powerful. The scene was shot in a single day. That morning, just before the first take was filmed, a private messenger served Farrow with formal divorce papers from Frank Sinatra. As she read the documents, Farrow fell to her knees on the kitchen floor and openly wept in front of the cast and crew. Roman Polanski insisted that the day be canceled and that filming be postponed until the next day, when he would start consecutively filming as many scenes as possible that did not contain Rosemary. Farrow openly would not accept this, insisting that nothing had been changed, and the day's filming concluded on time and without delay. Oh, and when Farrow was reluctant to film a scene that depicted a dazed and preoccupied Rosemary wandering into the middle of a Manhattan street into oncoming traffic, Polanski pointed to her pregnancy padding and reassured her, "No one's going to hit a pregnant woman." The scene was successfully shot with Farrow walking into real traffic and Polanski following along, operating the handheld camera since he was the only one willing to do it. "You, sir, have brass cojones, Mr. Roman Polanski." Massive, massive brass cojones. To operate a camera into oncoming traffic. Very brave man, very brave. And that was very considerate of him to try and postpone filming until she felt ready for it. But Mia Farrow was a trooper, and her performance in this film is fantastic, and it shows. The film was to be produced by, or was produced by, William Castle, who originally wanted to direct the film. Now, Castle is an interesting character. He was sort of the American low-budget version of Hitchcock, but I mean that with respect. He was a showman. He did a lot of gimmicks in his films to promote his films, and his films are fun. In fact, I just saw Homicidal recently, which is quite a good film and deserves to be discussed in its own right. Famously, he directed House on Haunted Hill, the original with Vincent Price, and 13 Ghosts and The Tingler, and all these other great, fun, low-budget but very fun black-and-white movies that were popcorn movies. And he would use gimmicks like inflatable skeletons and buzzers in the seats and all kinds of fun stuff like that. He deserves an episode in his own right. Castle wanted to direct this film, but because of his reputation, you know, for gimmickry, the studio felt that it needed a more dramatic touch, and so Roman Polanski was brought in to direct instead, and Polanski also adapted the screenplay, because it is a serious novel. It's a very serious film as well. Castle does have a cameo in the film. There's a scene where Rosemary's in a phone booth, and she's trying to call her doctor, and there's this man with gray hair, this rather heavy-set gentleman with gray hair outside the phone booth, and as soon as Rosemary leaves the booth, this man turns around, smoking a cigar, smiles at her, and then walks into the booth. Castle, much like Alfred Hitchcock, would do cameos in his films. And he would say, "Hi, I'm William Castle, and this is my new movie," you know, and then he would introduce the film. And Castle would always wear a suit, just like Hitchcock, and he'd be smoking a cigar. Very, very fun films that he had directed. Great filmmaker, a very fun guy, and just a very warm personality. Robert Redford was originally considered for the role of Guy, but he turned it down. Jack Nicholson was also considered, but Roman Polanski suggested John Cassavetes. Now there's a scene where, and I actually think Cassavetes was the right choice. Jack Nicholson would have been interesting in this role, but I don't think Jack would have been quite right for it. In fact, with all due respect, he made a fantastic devil in Witches of Eastwick, and if Jack was playing the devil in this film, that would have been really cool. But I don't see him as Guy. I see him more as, I would see him more playing a more dominating character. But anyways, John Cassavetes played the role and did it remarkably well. There was a scene where Rosemary is on the phone talking to an actor that, there was a plot that Guy Or Rosemary believes that Guy has basically offered up their baby as a sacrifice in order to curry favor with the Dark One. And that as a result, good things will start happening to Guy and Rosemary. Like, Rosemary becomes pregnant, and Guy gets the lead role in a play that he's been auditioning for. As it turns out, the baby's not a sacrifice. The baby is the son of Satan. And that's not a spoiler. It's pretty clear to you, you know, during the satanic sex scene. Anywho's, there's a scene where Rosemary calls up the actor that was up for this part. The actor has mysteriously become blind, and as a result he cannot play the part. And so Rosemary calls him to check up on him, and, you know, she's putting two and two together and figuring everything out. So this is the actor that Guy won the part over. And while they were shooting this scene, it was literally a phone call on the set. And Mia Farrow recognized the voice, but just couldn't place a face to it or place a name to it, but it just sounded familiar to her. And the voice on the phone was Tony Curtis. And it's plain as day when you hear him now, but yeah, she was like, I know who this is, I just don't recognize it. And Roman Polanski did that on purpose, because he wanted the look of confusion to be genuine on Mia Farrow's face. He did not want her to, you know, acknowledge this person and give that sense of recognition. So she didn't know that it was going to be Tony Curtis. She didn't know who it was going to be that was going to be on the phone. And it wasn't until after they had finished that scene that Polanski revealed who it was. So, further notes. The Dakota apartment building was the shooting locale for this film. And in the film, it is called... Let me see... Bramford. It's called the Bramford building in this film. And, yes, the Dakota apartment building, which... At one time, Boris Karloff had lived in that building. Famously, John Lennon lived the remaining years of his life in that building, and unfortunately, died there. So in real life, that building does have a notorious history. Unfortunately, but that's the way it goes. A remake was briefly considered by Michael the Child Dream Destroyer Bay. Thank you for screwing up Nightmare on Elm Street. Ugh. And the Transformers and everything else, Michael Bay. You just want to destroy everybody's childhood, don't you? Anyways, the remake fell through in 2008. Thank God, or whatever principalities prevented the remake, because it would have ruined a perfectly good film. Anyways, that's just a little brief snippet, summary of Rosemary's Baby. I could go on further, but again, this is a fantastic film, and I would encourage people who have not seen it to see it. I highly recommend it. It's a film that I've enjoyed from the very day I saw it, and still enjoy very, very much. A couple of points I wanted to throw out, too, about why this makes for great horror. It makes for a great drama, and it makes for a great horror film. And again, it's that element of the unknown. This is something that everybody who's a parent can testify to. Will my baby be healthy? Will the baby be normal, quote-unquote? Will the baby look like me? Will the baby look like the mother? Will the baby walk on two legs, you know? Will the baby be born healthy and normal? And that's something that Grace kind of talks to as well, although I think it's presented better in Rosemary's Baby, especially since there was some physical trauma. Well, there's physical trauma in both, but it just seems to be more realistically rendered in Rosemary's Baby. You feel for Madeline in Grace, and you feel for Rosemary. But I just seem to feel that, I don't know, that there was a greater air of realism, even though both films deal with kind of the unreal. It says Sanford Meisner said, acting is being real under unreal circumstances. And in both cases, the actresses delivered. They were very real in very unreal circumstances, and it pays off, and it helps to sell the ideas, it helps to sell the stories in both films. One could say that Rosemary's Baby, and this is something that occurred to me rewatching it now, at the very end of the film, that it's not so much about a woman giving birth to Satan's kid, that it's almost like a commentary on religion in general. It's a commentary on organized religion, almost a spoof on the idea of the Immaculate Conception. In the Immaculate Conception, and I don't want to get too deeply invested in religion here, but it does come up when you mention the devil. You have a child being born of a god. And this is something that came up when I talked about the Wicker Man. There's that line in the Wicker Man, Christ was conceived by a god. Oh no, Christ is the son of a god, conceived by a ghost, I believe. And his mom was a virgin. And Rosemary's Baby, Rosemary's not a virgin. She is a young woman, though. And she gets pregnant by the devil. In Christian theology, you have Christ, who is the son of a god, and yet at the same time, he's also a god. And his mom is, by tradition, a virgin, although it's a mistranslation. It's really supposed to be a young woman, but years and years of tradition have stated that she is a virgin. And so you have a child being born of a virgin whose mom was pregnant by a god. Very bizarre stuff in and of itself, regardless of your religious beliefs. In the case of Rosemary's Baby, it's the inversion of that, where a woman is pregnant via Satan. And granted, how could a spiritual entity that doesn't have a physical body get a woman pregnant? We don't know. So it's the anti-Immaculate Conception. It's the reverse of it. And there's that commentary on organized religion and what people do based upon faith, what people do based upon their religious beliefs, and how far they can go with it, and how far it can be taken. In this case, it's basically someone selling their soul, making a deal with the devil for success and for parenthood, and the consequences that follow with that. And then there's this child that is unaware that it's the spawn of Satan. And there's Rosemary in this difficult situation. What do I do now? She's protected this child as best as she can, for as long as she can, and, there is this stunning climax that I will not reveal to anybody. It's an amazing scene. The end of this film is just fantastic, and it needs to be seen to be appreciated. And then there's that element, of course, of body horror, of what is happening to the woman's body while she is pregnant, and what is growing inside of her, And this is something that is commented on in The Omen, to a certain extent. We have a child who doesn't know that he's the Antichrist. He's a bad seed. He doesn't know why he's a bad seed, he just is. And Damien is Damien. In fact, I could have added that to this list as well, but Damien doesn't stay a baby throughout the entire film. And he grows up as the series goes on, and I just felt that The Omen deserved its own episode, and it would have just been a little too much for this episode. So, before it gets to be too much now, that is my overview of Rosemary's Baby, a great classic, one of Roman Polanski's best films, a fantastic movie, great performance by Mia Farrow and the entire cast. I have not read any of Ira Levin's novels, but I would be curious to read Rosemary's Baby for myself. He also wrote, quite famously, The Boys from Brazil and The Stepford Wives, and I've seen the original films based upon those works, and those films were good, so I'd be curious to read his actual work for myself. He passed away in 2007, and I remember reading about it. I remember reading about his death, and being somewhat surprised by it. But he had a very long, very successful career as a writer, and we have several movies based on his works, and his books are in print, and it's there for us to experience and enjoy. So, next up, From the Vaults, and then Scream Queen of the Week.
Thank you.
my lovelies, from a very satisfying bathroom break. Too much information? Too frickin' bad. So this week's From the Vaults. There are multiple films I could have put in here, actually. I just watched a few last night that could qualify for a From the Vaults segment, and I may incorporate those in future episodes. One of them, definitely, I will, Vampire Circus, which is a Hammer film, but that deserves a separate discussion. The film for the From the Vaults segment tonight is Hudson Hawk, which I recently watched on Hulu. I don't know how long they're going to keep it up there, but it's up there for your perusal, and I greatly recommend watching it. It stars Bruce Willis, Andy McDowell, and Danny Aiello, and this is a film that was largely pushed aside when it was released. It was released around the same time as Terminator 2, if I'm not mistaken, and a couple of other big-name films were released that summer as well. So this film was pretty much buried. Critics basically turned their noses up at it. Basically, it was totally panned. Critics just totally discredited this film, and unjustifiably so. This is a film that has gotten a second life on DVD, and among podcasters, it is becoming a very popular film. And after seeing it for the first time myself, I can understand why. It's not a perfect film, but it's a very funny film, and it was very well done, and it deserved better than what it was given. In fact, Chinstroker vs. Punter recently recorded an episode about this film, where they talked about it in detail, and I would highly recommend that listeners check out Chinstroker vs. Punter, just to check out Chinstroker vs. Punter, but in particular, check out this episode where they talk about Hudson Hawk. They really give it its proper due, and Noel Miller of Film Rant also gave it its proper due, and I'm going to give it its proper due very, very briefly, but albeit briefly, but still its proper due. It is a very funny film. It's about a guy named Eddie, played by Bruce Willis, who was nicknamed the Hudson Hawk, because he's a famous cat burglar. Hawk is a wind, a very fast, cold-moving wind that comes off the Hudson River, hence his nickname, Hudson Hawk, the wind that comes in and goes very gracefully. He is a world-famous cat burglar. He's been serving about 15 years up in Sing Sing Prison. He is released, and immediately after he has been released, he gets basically shanghaied into performing one last robbery and stealing a famous horse that was sculpted by Leonardo da Vinci. And the whole film is about this quest to recover these pieces of this crystal that will start up this machine that da Vinci had invented that can turn bronze into gold. It's elements of fantasy, high action, and a lot of very quirky humor. It has a very dark, very quirky, silly sense of humor to it. If you like Guy Ritchie films, like Snatch and Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, that's the kind of humor in this film. It is an action comedy, and it has that same kind of bizarro sense of humor, albeit in a slightly lighter vein. It's not as dark as the Guy Ritchie films, although there are some darker moments in it. And the humor in it is just fantastic. I was laughing out loud. And it has very highly quotable dialogue, and fantastic music as well in the film. Especially the scene where Willis and Aiello sing the Bing Crosby standard, Swingin' on a Star, while they're doing a robbery. It's a very fun scene, and I was actually tapping my foot along with it. There's, you know, famously one of the best lines in the film, taken in the ear for a beer, you know, that Aiello says. Bruce Willis says, 1-800, how's my driving? 1-800, I'm gonna fucking die. You know? They're just great lines in this film. It's highly quotable. And, again, I don't want to say too much more, because this is a film that people need to see. And it's nice to see that it's getting a second life among podcasters and on DVD. And it deserves it. It really does. And I recommend that everyone go to Hulu.com, that's HULU.com, and watch this film. I'm going to see about embedding this film on the Blogspot site. I believe Hulu allows you to embed film. I don't know how long they're going to keep it up there, but for as long as it's up there, people will be able to access it and see it, or go to your local video store and rent it, or because this film is probably, you can probably get the DVD fairly cheaply. Just go and buy the DVD and get it from a discount shop, or see if you can get it fairly cheaply, or get it online. But it is a very fun film, and worth a revisit, and worth getting a giving a second life to, which is what From the Vaults is all about.
A chill runs up your spine and crawls into your brain.
Yes, it is time for another new segment, Scream Queen of the Week. And I figured that for the inaugural Scream Queen, it should be someone very special, someone that I'm a fan of, and, well, someone that I quite frankly have a massive crush on. So that would be Emma Stone. Born Emily Jean Stone, November 6th, 1988, aged 22. Best known for her roles in Zombieland, she was recently cast as Gwen Stacy in the reboot of the Spider-Man film series. Emma Stone was born in Scottsdale, Arizona, the daughter of Jeff Stone, a contractor, and Krista Stone. Oddly enough, Krista is the name of her character in Zombieland. Wichita was the character's place of birth, the town she was named after, but Krista was her real name. She has a brother who is younger by 2 years. Stone's paternal grandfather was of Swedish descent, and her family lived in Pennsylvania Dutch country. Her family surname was anglicized to Stone when emigrating to the U.S. through Ellis Island. She was a member of the Valley Youth Theater while growing up in a regional theater in Phoenix, Arizona. And just a little bit of her CV and her career here. Let's see. VH1 competition talent show. Yes, Stone launched a career on television after winning the role of Lori Partridge on In Search of the New Partridge Family in 2004, a VH1 talent reality show. The resulting show, The New Partridge Family, only produced a pilot episode. Stone next had appearances in the television series Medium, which I'm also a fan of, Malcolm in the Middle, and Lucky Louie. In 2007, she had a regular role on the Fox drama Drive, which starred Nathan Fillion. The series only ran for 7 episodes, though. She was then cast in The House Bunny, starring Anna Faris, Kat Dennings, and Rumor Willis, the daughter of Bruce Willis. Yeah, there's a double Willis in this episode. And Colin Hanks. Was then cast in Ghost of Girlfriends Past in 2009, directed by Mark Waters, the director of Mean Girls. And it starred Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Garner. She was then cast in Zombieland, starring Woody Harrelson and Jesse Eisenberg, and co-starring Abigail Breslin. And as for upcoming films, she'll be in the new Spider-Man movies as the role of Gwen Stacy. And speaking of which, Ms. Stone is a natural blonde, although famously a redhead. She began dyeing it red after her role in Superbad. And in Zombieland, she is, well, has auburn hair in Zombieland, but famously known as a redhead. And you can check out her CV, both film and television, on Wikipedia. I'm going to post a link to the article, which I used as my source material for this segment. The lovely Ms. Stone is drop-dead gorgeous, very talented, was absolutely fantastic in Zombieland and in anything else I've seen her in. And I'm just a huge, huge fan of her. Absolutely adore her. Oh, and most recently, she was in Easy A, which I have yet to see, but I'm pretty damn sure I'm going to enjoy it. In fact, I will see if I can post the video of her singing Knock on Wood, which one of my friends had posted to Facebook. And yeah, I was completely blown away. Seeing Emma Stone in a corset, you just can't go wrong there. That will definitely brighten your day. I imagine that people who are getting ready to jump off bridges, if you look at a picture of Emma Stone, whether she's wearing a corset or not, you will stop yourself from jumping off a bridge. Those of you who are atheists, you will be convinced that God exists if you see a photo of Emma Stone, regardless of what she's wearing. The mere presence of this young woman convinces you that there may very well be some kind of divine influence in the universe. So, that is Scream Queen of the Week. And now I just want to give out a couple of final thoughts. There's an issue that I've been thinking of recently. It has a talking point, but more than a talking point, because I feel that it's pretty serious. As serious as a genre issue can go. Because it can get very frustrating when the bees get in our bonnets when it concerns genres and genres that we enjoy and when things go amiss. Like really crappy remakes, Michael Bay. Stop it! Stop remaking perfectly good films. Stop it! Stop it! I command you, stop it! In the name of Cthulhu, stop it! Now I'm gonna stop it. So here's the issue. This is something that will be addressed as a talking point, but before I do that, I'm gonna call on you, the listeners, to give me some feedback. I recently sent out some feedback to people who subscribe to the Facebook group, which is Flypaper Dungeon Podcast on Facebook. Just look me up on there, and you can find it. And that is this. Due to the recent cancellation of Caprica and Stargate Universe, and the fact that nothing big has happened in sci-fi for the past 10 years, really, is the sci-fi genre dying, or is it just dormant? This is something that Dylan brought up a few months ago. We were talking about different genres and what's big in different genres, and he came up with a very astute observation that in science fiction there hasn't been anything big in recent years. Now, there was, well, let me rephrase that. There is the glorious reboot of Star Trek, the fantastic J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, absolutely brilliant rebirth of Star Trek. So we saw a reboot of Star Trek, just fantastic, gorgeously done. We have seen continuations of old franchises. Stargate ended its very long and very successful run of 11 seasons. Yay, Stargate, because it was a great show. We then saw Stargate Atlantis, but that wasn't quite as good and didn't last quite as long. So that ended its run fairly quickly. It ran for a few seasons, ran for about 4 or 5 seasons, I think. But wasn't quite as good as the original Stargate, didn't run quite as long. We now have seen the death of Stargate Universe, which I would need to rewatch again. I watched a few episodes of it. Thought it was okay, but I would have to rewatch it. It did feel a bit like a Lost clone, which is my issue with the Walking Dead TV series. It's too Lost-like, but that's another discussion. We saw, Firefly ran very briefly, just 9 episodes, and was canceled. And that was some years ago at this point. It's been over, what, 7 years now? 8 years that Firefly ran? And I was a fan of that show. I enjoyed it. And it wasn't until I lived in California that I met other fans of it, oddly enough. Nobody where I grew up watched the show, and I tried to get people to watch it. Nobody would. And then years later, I discovered this massive fan base for the show. Quite thankfully. It's nice to know that it wasn't some obscure show that just I watched. It's nice to know that other people got into it as well. Mostly retroactively, though. Which is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I got into a lot of things retroactively. But anyways, we saw Firefly. We saw the end of the Star Wars saga. We saw the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, the brilliant reboot of Battlestar Galactica, which I really enjoyed. So we saw reboots and rebirths and remakes of old franchises, respectively. We saw continuations of old franchises like Stargate. But we haven't seen anything really new. We haven't seen the next Star Trek come up. There was Babylon 5 in the 90s, but, you know, that has been ended for quite some time. And that's another story right there. But for the past 10 years, in this decade, or in the past decade, we haven't seen anything new. Reboots, rebirths, remakes, but nothing new. We've seen the end of certain franchises. Lucas wants to do a Star Wars TV series, a live-action TV series, as well as the animated Clone Wars series. And that's good. That's all well and good, and I look forward to seeing that. But we haven't seen anything really new. Anything as big as Star Wars come along for a very, very long time. The new Battlestar Galactica, you know, was very original and does have a massive fan base, but it was, again, a remake of a previously existing series. We haven't seen anything from scratch come out that was brand new and innovative and has captured the public consciousness the way that Star Wars and Star Trek did. So the question lies, with Sci-Fi Channel changing its name and the proliferation of B-movies on the Sci-Fi Channel and the cancellation of a lot of its key series, is science fiction kind of dying? We've seen a renewed interest, or at least going dormant, we've seen a renewed interest in fantasy in recent years. Harry Potter is very big. Lord of the Rings came back in a big way. We've seen a lot of sword and sorcery books flying off the shelves. Not so much a revival of sword and sorcery on television or at the cinema, which very surprises me. Very much surprised that there hasn't been a massive sword and sorcery outpouring in movies and in television. There was that show The Legend of the Seeker, but that really didn't, it didn't last long. We've seen a massive revival of Sword and Sandal, which Dylan and I were talking about last night. Again, you know, Sword and Sandal was revived with Gladiator and 300 and Rome and Empire on ABC and Spartacus Blood and Sand and so on. So there's been quite a decent revival of Sword and Sandal, but not so much a revival of science fiction or a revival of, a revival of science fiction. Science fiction seems to be like it's going in a dormancy phase. Horror is tops right now, and I've always felt of that horror and science fiction were like cousins, or brother and sister, or in some cases incestuous twins, because there's a lot of overlap between the two. So, you know, is sci-fi going through a dormancy period? You can have your cake and eat it too. You can like sci-fi and horror. I like both. I just seem to prefer horror more than science fiction. But, you know, are they going through a dormancy period here? Is science fiction going through dormancy? So let me know what you think upon that, and email me at flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. And so that's a talking point that I want to address in a future episode and give my opinion on it, which I kind of already did, but I want to hear from you, the listeners, what you think. Is science fiction going dormant, or is it dying off for a period? What do you think is going on? What is the current state of science fiction? So please email me at flypaperdungeon@gmail.com and let me know what you think. And give me your thoughts and your opinions on this episode on the topic, is sci-fi going dormant or dying? And I would also like to give a call for smutty emails. I made a call for that on the very first episode, and didn't get a single smutty, sexy, perverse email. But Valentine's Day is coming up in February, so I'm going to give a call out for your sexiest, dirtiest, smuttiest email, and only the filthiest, sexiest ones will be read on air. So send me your smutty emails, your opinion of the talking point about science fiction, and your comments on the show and on the topic of the show. So, that is this week's episode, Evil Babies. Thank you very much for listening. I'm your host, Johnny Zombie. The website address for this podcast is flypaperdungeon.blogspot.com. My email address is flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, And as for next week's topic, I'm not entirely sure, but I may be doing a Vincent Price double feature at the late night double feature picture show by RKO. You want to go? I want to come. We all agree upon that. And fuck the back row. So, until next week, I am Johnny Zombie, over and out.